by transcription.
Greetings, America. This is Ben Grauer. Listen to the recorded voice of war veteran Charles Wright of Lorain, Ohio.
My wife and I been married 4 years yesterday, and we've never had a front room yet. Looking for the big day when we can come out and have a eat supper and go in the front room and leave the dishes sit for a few minutes and read a paper together.
We bring you now the inspiring story of how other veterans who felt just as Charles Wright did about the housing shortage got together in a typically American way to do something about it.
Living 1951, in cooperation with the 20th Century Fund, presents the sixth of a special series of programs entitled The People Act, designed to show you how your fellow Americans are uniting in democratic ways to solve for themselves the problems of living. This program we call Home is What They Made It. Field reporter, Elmore McKee.
Hello, everyone. Today, you're going to meet the sixth group of new friends whom we've made on our cross-country journey in search of the essence of this thing called democracy that we're fighting for in our struggle for a free world. So far, we've been hunting in North Carolina, Connecticut, Kansas, Kentucky, and Arkansas. But nowhere have I come upon people taking local responsibility in more down-to-earth, democratic fashion than among a resolute band of veterans who have undertaken a self-help housing project out along the windy shores of Lake Erie at Lorain, Ohio. We recorded their heartening story in their own words. That you may hear it, I return you now to Ben Grauer.
Forty minutes by bus out of Cleveland along the Erie shore, and you find yourself on the soot-drenched outskirts of Lorain, Ohio. Here, you tell yourself, is a typical American industrial town, indistinguishable from a score of other towns in the busy Middle West. Yet today, because of the gallant gamble of some 40 young men in it, men whose names range from A for ACOs to Y for UHAS, Lorain, Ohio has a very real distinction and a special meaning for us all. We begin the story in the words, just as we recorded them, of one of those men, Al Lash. Al Lash, war veteran and steel worker.
Well, I served with the Seabees during the last war. Most of the time I served on Guam. When I was discharged and returned home, why, of course, the wife and I were interested in having a place of our own. We have been ever since we were married.
A place of their own. The age-old hope of every young couple. A normal dream in disjointed times. As he went to and from his job, as he chatted with his neighbors and fellow workers, Al Lash heard how they, too, shared the hope of a home of their own. And why? Men like Bill Juhas, Bill Ivanchik, families like the Speckharts, the Altamires, the Burnses, the Reardons, and Kachers.
I lived in three rooms and baths with my mother-in-law and the son. I even had to sell my living room outfit to make room for a bedroom outfit for my mother-in-law.
Ever since I came home from the Pacific, we dreamt of a home of our own. And at first, we lived with my mother in one room, my wife and I, and then all of a sudden, my wife was expecting, well, that's it.
We only had three rooms, and we were living upstairs, and it was kind of hard to kids didn't run up and down the steps all the time.
Well, I was living in a four-room, unpainted house here in town without a bathroom. And, well, it just wasn't much of a place to live. It's a shack, that's all.
We were expecting an addition to our family, and we had an attic apartment, which wasn't very good. And the landlord claimed that if we had any children, we'd have to leave.
I was living in my dad's home,
with my husband, my two brothers, and my little boy. Then my sister and her husband and two children got evicted, so they came in with us. That was nine of us in a three-bedroom home.
In such surroundings, the Lashers couldn't but be housing conscious, even if their own needs and interests hadn't filled their Sunday afternoons with a long and fruitless search.
We looked at different lots. We looked at different homes that were built, and although they were nice, the prices were just too high. I was still an apprentice, and we couldn't afford it at that time to go into the costs.
There were building lots, yes, new houses even, but for an apprentice steel worker, the prices were simply out of reach. It was discouraging, even hopeless. Then one night, as Al Lash tells it,
After I'd been home about 3 or 4 months, I happened to pick up Reader's Digest, and in there I read an article about Pencraft. It's a self-help housing project put on in Pennsylvania by the American Friends Service Committee.
Yes, on the soot-blackened hills of a rural slum in Pennsylvania, some courageous miners had faced the same kind of problem and had solved it. Listeners to this series will recall how they pooled their labor, the labor of their own hands, how they'd built homes for themselves. Al Lash threw down the magazine and began to think.
I figured that if a bunch of coal miners down in Pennsylvania could go and build themselves homes like that without any skills, there's no reason why us steelworkers here in Lorain couldn't do the very same thing.
An idea and a challenge. There it was in Al Lash's mind, and it wouldn't lie still, and it wouldn't go away. So he began to share the notion with his friends, among them Don Poplar at National Tube.
When I came back from Germany, I returned to my job as a molder at the National Tube Company. There I met Al Lash, and he told me of this idea of building homes. I was very excited about it and thought that the idea was very well thought out. And the first thing I could do was call my wife and tell her about it.
How does an idea become a plan of action? Listen.
When Don called me up and told me about the possibility of us having a home, I got all excited and egged him on and told him to get into the project.
Yes, suddenly it became a project, and the idea of building their own home spread like contagion among the steelworkers of Lorain. But was it practical? Could it be done? It had been done, and back in Pennsylvania they could find the evidence.
Some of us thought that it would be a good idea if we go down to Pencraft and see if these homes actually were built, if they were real.
They wanted to see for themselves, fortify their own resolve with a glimpse of the self-built homes of Pencraft. They turned to their union, United Steelworkers of America, Local 1104, and Paul Shrimp, its president.
They asked me if the local would stand the cost of their trip to Pennsylvania. I thought they would, and we took the matter up with our executive committee, and it was okayed immediately.
At Pencraft, the men from Lorain saw, in the convincing testimony of building blocks and timber, that it could be done. And they also made contact with an agency of proven wisdom in these matters, the Self-Help Counseling Committee of the Society of Friends, and of its representative, Herford Crossman. As Crossman remembers it today,
the one thing that struck me very forcibly as I talked with them and got acquainted was their spirit and the fact that they really seemed to mean business. They really wanted houses bad.
To a good Quaker like Herford Crossman, a man who means business is a man who deserves a helping hand. He returned to Lorain with Lash and Poplar, surveyed the need, put the veterans in touch with two local experts, products of Antioch College nearby, an architect and a building engineer, Max Ratner and Doug Johnson. The first tangible step was to find a site, a place to build these homes, so said Ratner.
We then plotted on a map the possible area in which the site could be located and contacted farmers in that area who had unused land. One of them, Otto Neerum, finally agreed to sell us the land at about half the price that other farmers asked for similar land. And we recommended that the boys buy that site.
The time had come. The time to put up or shut up. But it meant digging very, very deep.
I put up $500, and it was a good part of the money I had, but I wanted a house so bad, and I figured I was one way to get it.
That was Frank Sislovsky. For Bill Ivanchik, Mike Maslow, Bill Juhas, for all of them, the stake was just as great.
The bonus money was just coming through, and I told my wife that we'd give them the $400 check, the bonus check, and then we borrowed $100 from National Tube.
I kicked in $200 at first, and it was rough. We needed the money, but somehow we got along.
I put up $500. I don't mind telling you, it worried me a little bit. After all, it was a risky business, and that was all the money I had.
So, at great sacrifice, the land was bought. But the ink was hardly dry on the deed before the disappointments began. The hope of a loan, which they were counting on to build the homes themselves, fell through. Nowhere could they find money with which to finance this unconventional project. Bankers are cautious men, and to them it seemed that any venture which is the responsibility of many is the solid obligation of none. Many of the veterans, bucking the stone wall of finance, went from impatience to frustration to disgust. Mrs. Al Lash remembers it well.
We encountered so many difficulties that there was times when I became so discouraged I thought it would be a good idea if we called it quits.
And that was just the temper of a stormy meeting at which Archie Broadfoot rose to express the general view.
We're paying the engineers or the project managers for their labor, and nothing's been done, not even surveyed. We're gambling on this property, and if the property value gets any less, and if we hang around any longer, we're going to lose more of our money. None of us can afford to lose $500 in such a start.
Amid murmurs of agreement, Al Lash got to his feet.
Well, now look, fellas. You know if you sell that land, you're going to lose on it.
Among these discouraged folks was one thoroughly aroused and angry man.
There ain't nobody going to go out that far and buy it and pay the money we paid for it. You got to get in and push. You can't back out in the thing now. You got to go. I'm going out to that darn site and build one decent house just to show the birds behind the cages at the bank that we can do it. And we can do it, and don't say we can't do it, because we can. People may think you're too jelly-bellied to do it, but you're not. We're going to go out there and show them, I don't care how unskilled you are, you're going to build that house, and you are going to build it.
It was a group of rededicated young men who turned out in force that weekend on what they were now determined would be the site of their future homes.
He told us to bring our axes along, and we were all pretty pepped up and started chopping trees, and we were all having fun to see who could chop the trees the fastest.
So Ray Washoe described the clearing. Don Poplar's there, too.
We all pitched in with all the effort we had because it was the real thing coming true. Well, our feeling on the first day of work was one of happiness.
Nor were the boys lacking an appreciative gallery. Among them, Sally Hleckbaugh.
It was quite amusing to watch the boys. They were like a bunch of amateurs. You could tell they'd hardly ever had a hammer or a saw in their hands before. And they grunted and groaned, and the sweat poured off their brows, and finally, when they went home, the girls afterwards said they were plenty of aching muscles, and they all made a beeline for the drugstore and bought a lot of liniment.
But early in the project, they decided that all this energy should go according to plan. Let Doug Johnson, co-manager, describe the rules.
The way a man puts in his time varies with the man. A man that works the revolving shifts in the steel plant may put in evenings 1 week, and then again, and then he'll put in mornings the following week. He may choose to put in 10 hours a day on his 2 days off, or he may put in 4 hours a day for 5 evenings. In any case, each man has to schedule 20 hours a week. Each man is a member of the corporation, and his agreement with the corporation is that he shall put in 20 hours a week until the project is finished. That is, until all of the houses are done, till each member has a house.
Soon, the stroke of axe on underbrush gives way to the sounds of building. One house is underway. Excavation holes for others dug, and all goes briskly until just short of roof height on house number one, again the money runs out. This was the time of deepest despair. Some of the veterans gave up. Others came perilously near.
I was for quitting because I was so tired of waiting and things just didn't seem right and all the turns down we got that I just wanted to go out and get a home for ourselves.
Worried wives forced themselves into the role of cheerleader.
There were nights when he came home complaining and saying he was going to quit, and I would tell him to wait till tomorrow and cool off. Things would look a little brighter the next day.
But in her heart, Mrs. Don Poplar feared that nothing could lift the gloom. The veterans had again dug down, $100 here, $200 there, and this time they really scraped the bottom of the barrel. The project seemed doomed. Then, in the nearby town of Oberlin, just in the nick of time, they found a friend.
I got acquainted with the project through Al Lash, who is a friend of mine. When I heard that they were short of money in order to buy materials to build the houses, I found that I had around $4,000 in the bank that wasn't doing anybody any good. And being a veteran myself and interested in cooperative projects, I decided to let them use it to help them build their houses. So I loaned them the $4,000 to help them build their houses.
That's the voice of Bill Long, a veteran himself, ex-Army captain, Oberlin storekeeper, and subscriber to the personal creed of trying to help those who help themselves. Revived by the tonic of Bill Long's $4,000 loan, solvent again in spirit and in fact, the builders went back to the job. 20 hours a week and every hour, 60 minutes of solid toil. And it was bound to happen now. It was as inevitable as fate. The great day which saw a completion of the first house. The house which proved it could be done. And whose house had they been building? They settled that by a simple drawing of lots. And the Andrew Kachers invited all their friends to a housewarming.
Believe me, that was the happiest day of my life. We had a grand celebration that day. All our neighbors and friends and relatives were over to help celebrate a grand opening of our home and our little boy's birthday.
It wasn't only a wonderful feeling for us, but it gave the other fellas a boost. You could see the improvement in her work the next day.
Yes, the next day and the next of the days after that. Now they were working with a purpose, and further, they were working with a plan. Listen to these sounds. They spell men at work on the housing project at Lorain, Ohio. Today, 22 houses stand completed and occupied, and still the work goes on. Against this background of building sounds, as we recorded them, the men themselves told us how it's going.
I've got 2,250 hours to my credit. I came out at 8 o'clock this morning, and I'm working on a septic tank at the Rose home. Next week, I expect to be in my own house. They're sanding the floors now.
Today, I am finishing off wallboard in Al Asher's house. The foundation on my own house was just dug this week.
Today, I'm installing a furnace at Al Aldemari's home. I'm an office worker by trade. I picked up a knowledge on installing furnaces through working on this project. I expect to put in 8 hours today, and I expect to put in 8 more hours tomorrow, Sunday.
I'm in time study and industrial engineering.
I work till 5 o'clock in the afternoon and come home and eat supper and come right out to work about 5:45. And I specialize mainly in finish work. I've learned everything I know about finish work right here on the project.
I worked on the first house, and now I'm working on a 23rd. And by God, that's some progress.
With which fervent observation we heartily concur. Some progress indeed. 22 attractive homes and more to come, where once there were only open farmland and a dream. And with the completion of new houses one by one, the veterans also found they had solved their money problem. They were able to mortgage each completed house against funds to construct the next. But along with the houses, along with roof and hearth and home, have come other values. Values less tangible, but just as real.
Working to build this veterans project and getting these homes up has created a bond between us that will exist as long as we are out here.
I've already got my own home, but I feel my buddies are entitled to their home just as much as I am to mine. So I figure it's my duty to keep going just as much now as when I did before I moved in my own home.
I was a rifleman with the infantry in Italy. I slogged through a lot of mud there, and I slogged through a lot of mud here, but they're both worth it at the end.
Well, I think it's wonderful, and I feel that God's been exceptionally good to us. When I say it, I really mean it from my heart.
But perhaps the most eloquent of all, the statement of little Jimmy Kacher, age 6.
I like it fine, because nobody lives here but us.
Nobody lives here but us. Each family with a home of its own. A dream realized for the veterans of Lorain, Ohio. All of which brings us back to the man whom we sent to Lorain as field reporter and who has watched the veterans' colony grow from 10 to 22 families in residence. Elmore McKee, how does this all look to you now?
Well, here again. This reporter feels we find the authentic core of democracy. These veterans faced a glaring need, houses. Leaders emerged from their midst. The men took responsibility altogether. They went to work, overcame gigantic obstacles, got their houses, and got something else too. A new respect for each other, a new solidarity. It all adds up to a tale of initiative and teamwork in a free country. The very costs of freedom we all too easily forget. The Lorain story is part of our country's strength, and it means something to the future of the world. It makes us see what can be done anywhere in the land when our people determine to work together pioneer fashion until they get results. Of course, houses are only the beginning of what these veterans are after. There will also be a park for the children, a community garden, a co-op store. Things full of hope, which Al Lash had in mind when he said,
"We want ours to be the example for more projects. It's not an answer to all housing, of course not. We know that. But we want everybody in America that's willing to work to have himself a decent home, even though he doesn't have the income to pay the higher costs today. We've done the job here, and anybody can do it anywhere else if they're willing to work."
All of us can honor the spirit and determination shown by Al Lash and his buddies in the Lorain Housing Project. But as Al Lash himself has just said, their story isn't necessarily the answer for all America. Now to get some facts on the housing picture for the nation as a whole, let's turn to the studies of the research foundation that is collaborating with NBC in producing these programs, the 20th Century Fund. Let's hear from Miles L. Colleen, writer, consultant, and authority on housing, who is director of research for the 20th Century Fund study entitled American Housing, Problems and Prospects, and who is now directing the fund's new survey of urban redevelopment. Here are Mr. Colleen's recorded observations as he talks with NBC's Mac McGarry in Washington.
Mr. Colleen, what do you think of our Lorain story?
That story is very heartwarming. We have to admire the pluck and resourcefulness of these young veterans. I suppose it leaves a lot of others itching to get their hands on some tools and lumber and start building a house.
And they probably would run into trouble if they did.
They very well might, if they didn't go about it in the same sensible way. The Lorain experience shows that a group of determined young fellows who are willing to work and you have expert guidance on technical matters, can get together and build their own homes. But for many of us, that probably is not a practical solution. What does apply to all of us and to all parts of the country is the continuing need for homes, especially homes for Americans of average income or less.
But surely the great house-building boom we've had since the end of the war has done something toward meeting this need.
Of course it has. Dwellings for almost 5 million families have been built since the end of the war. But you must remember that the demand is still very great. The Depression years of the 1930s and the war years themselves put us far behind in meeting our normal requirement for new houses. While the war was still going on, our survey of the 20th Century Fund estimated that this country probably could utilize about 1 million new homes a year for 10 years after the war ended.
We're now a little more than 5 years past the end of the war. We should be halfway through our program. But have we ever succeeded in building new dwellings, and I take it that means houses or apartment units, at the rate of 1 million a year?
Not until 1949 did we actually start construction on as many as 1 million new dwellings in 1 year. Last year in 1950, however, we started building nearly 1.5 million.
And now we have a new crisis as our country enters on its big rearmament program.
Yes, practically all the experts agree that this will mean some reduction in house building. Just how much reduction, it is hard to say. Estimates run all the way from 30% to 60%. Meanwhile, our population is growing rapidly. It seems certain that we shall have a continuing pressing demand for new houses for some years to come.
And does the rearmament crisis present some special problems of its own?
It does. And we have some experience to guide us. Back in 1940, when this country embarked upon a defense program, the 20th Century Fund made a special survey of defense housing problems. The fund offered two basic principles that seem especially important.
Do they apply today?
I think they do. Our housing survey strongly recommended that in locating war industries, that is, in building new plants or in military supplies, we should put those plants where there is some chance of meeting the housing needs of the workers. Housing plans should be made a basic and essential part of the whole project.
Well, that does seem sensible today.
Another principle was to be particularly cautious about temporary housing. Experience has shown that much housing supposed to be temporary never is. It stays on and on. There is no excuse for building ramshackle, unfit structures. Even for emergency purposes, housing should be simply planned and soundly built. Otherwise, we shall be providing misfit structures for our present workers and creating slums for the future.
Thank you, Mr. Miles Colleen, director of the 20th Century Fund's Studies of Housing and of Urban Redevelopment.
This is Ben Grauer again in New York. Whether we are directly concerned with house building or not, I'm sure that all of us can take heart from the courage and example of the Ohio veterans and builders of their own homes. In their project, they are showing true helpfulness toward each other, an instance of American democracy in action. Living 1951, in conjunction with the 20th Century Fund, has presented another in our special series, The People Act. If you wish to receive a copy of today's script, or to ask questions pertaining to the possible application of the Lorraine story to your own community, you're invited to write to the 20th Century Fund, 330 West 42nd Street, New York 18. We repeat that address, the 20th Century Fund, 330 West 42nd Street, New York 18. The fund will be glad to send you a script or put you in touch with an agency that may help you in your situation. 2 weeks from today, our program will be heard an hour and a half earlier over most of these same stations. Join us again next week when our field reporter will introduce us to some people who put democracy to work in Lawton, Oklahoma. The People Act is produced for NBC and the 20th Century Fund by the Program Unit for Living 1951, Wade Arnold, producer and editor, Kenneth McGregor, studio director, Lou Hazem, writer, Elmore McKee, field reporter, Ben Grauer, narrator, and William Swartow, recording engineer.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.